You're listening to Farmer's Kitchen on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With Spinneys. Eat well, live well.
Helen Farmer with you. It was a very special Farmer's Kitchen Live the last Friday of the month, and we were cooking in the kitchen at Spinneys with Chef Kelvin of Jun's. He was making his mum's chicken curry, and it was incredible. Don't forget, you can watch that on YouTube as well. We're also in conversation with one of the best chefs on the planet. Chef Debes Munoz has been voted that accolade three times consecutively, and he's opened up Streetso here in Dubai. It was Rib and Bell, the family-focused restaurant that is now sold out. We were speaking to founder Yulia and talking nutrition. Rita joining us as we talked about disordered eating and how to improve your relationship with food. Great to have you with us. We are live on your radio, of course, as ever on a Friday afternoon. It's Helen Farm with you for Farmer's Kitchen. But we're actually cooking today in the Spinneys Maidan HQ. This is the test kitchen. So as you will have seen, they have got Spinneys cafes and food halls around the UAE and beyond now. So this is where chefs come together to create, to try, to test, think about how could this work on a bigger scale. And it's also where we take over every single Friday afternoon and invite our very own favourite chefs to come in and cook for you. So you can listen, of course, as many of you are on the Dubai Eye radio, but I would urge you, hop on over to our YouTube channel, Dubai Eye 103.8 FM, and you can watch what's happening. Chef Kelvin Chung is with us today from Jun's, and we are making not one, not two, but three dishes. We are making his mum's Sunday chicken curry. We're just about to get a bone broth going as well. And if you, like me, love an air fryer, stay with us. We've got some great tips. Not only by watching, you might see a few bloopers as well. Those of you who are on the YouTube channel can also win. We've selected some gorgeous ingredients from Spinneys. We've got spices, we've got oils, we've got, of course, this beautiful chicken as well. You could be winning all of the ingredients delivered to your door, so you can make it yourself. So here's what I want to know from you. Get into the comments. You can send any questions in, of course, for me and Kelvin, but to win this prize, and this is only on the YouTube, by the way, tell me, many of us, hopefully, have been paid, it's the end of the month, when you've been paid and you go to the supermarket, what's your payday treat? What do you find yourself putting into the basket when other times of the month you might be like, oh, I can't really justify it. I went to Spinneys this morning and it was all the frozen berries. I was like, frozen cherries, frozen blueberries, raspberries, strawberries. Because then I've got smoothies sorted the rest of the month. Chef Kelvin, what about you? And we should say you're a little bit different because you've got amazing access to ingredients all month long. But is there anything you're like, oh, I'm going to treat myself?
To be honest, we do like to splurge when we head out to the fresh fruit and vegetable souk and market. I think that's a great tip for a lot of our Dubai residents. If you're ever in need of a easy access to pristine, good quality vegetables and fruits that are pretty much restaurant quality, because that's where we buy most of our stuff is.
Industry insider.
Yeah. You just go and you'll walk into their walk-in and you'll find anything that you want from all over the world.
Chef Kelvin is with us today. As I said, we're starting with a broth. Loads of people, including my kids, are sick right now. So we're making a broth that you say you have kind of on the boil pretty much all the time. Mm-hmm. You've just kind of jointed some chicken here. What have you been massaging into it, Chef?
So this, I just put a little bit of high smoke oil, so any neutral oil. And depending on your family, depending on what your kids' partners like to eat, feel free to season it as much as you want or not. In our house, generally at home, we tend to eat a little bit cleaner, so we avoid too much sodium, anything too overly processed and such. So whenever we do this kind of broth, we roast the chicken pretty plainly. So this is just some oil, a little bit of salt and pepper, and we'll just cook it fully all the way.
So this has gone into an air fryer, but I can honestly say, for those of you watching on YouTube, you'll see it. Probably one of the fanciest air fryers I've ever seen. mine, we got ours for that reason, for kind of health reasons, that we didn't want to be using too much oil we were cooking, but actually it's become a go-to for a lot of things. Heating up pizza, just saying. Tell us a little bit about what you use yours for at home. We've got chicken going on today, but what other things are you using your air fryer for?
We are air fryer and smart pot obsessed.
Are you really?
Yeah, it's on all day, all morning, all night. I've noticed that things like the air fryer, especially for vegetables, work great, especially if you have little ones at home, a little bit fussier. And for them, I'm able to control the amount of extra stuff that I'm putting onto the vegetables. Mm-hmm. So whether it be just some crispy potatoes, some charred carrots, some carrot potato fries, last minute. It takes a couple of minutes. There's less to clean up. Just chop, cut, throw it in there, and it takes, like, it's a no-brainer, right?
So our chicken is air frying. Can I ask what setting you've put this on, just for anyone who wants to be cooking along?
So generally, whenever I do chicken in the air fryer, I'll put it skin side down for the first couple of minutes, whether it be a whole chicken, whether it be the legs, whether it be whatever it may be. And then I'll give it a couple of minutes at 200, 210, just to kind of sear the outsides. After a couple of minutes, I'll flip it. We'll turn it down to about 180, 185. And depending if it's a whole chicken's like anywhere from 20 to 24 minutes, depending on the size. Mm-hmm. These are just legs that I cut so that it'll be a little faster for us. This will probably take around 15 minutes, so it'll be good.
Are you going to be using meat thermometers or you... No, he knows it. He's too good. I would use a meat thermometer. Chef Calvin, we're making the broth right now.
Yes.
What else is going in there? Because something already smells amazing.
So this is what I'm going to show you. As we're prepping for our curry, like for example, a carrot, you're going to have carrot peels, you're going to have the top, you'll probably have some bottoms. Even when you cut your onions and garlic, you have all these odds and ends. Mm-hmm. And why throw them away? So all of this will end up in our pot.
And so literally just the tops of carrots?
Anything.
Peels?
Peels, as long as it's washed cleanly and it's a better quality vegetable,
yeah.
That's the perfect way to not have any waste.
Wow.
So we'll just peel them and then that'll go in. Just make sure you wash them well and toss it all in.
Right, you're going to do some chopping. I'm going to do some questions because I need to know a little bit more about you. So as you said, born in Toronto. I used to live in Toronto, one of the best foodie cities.
Love it. It's ever. One of the best places in the world.
I never did winter there. That's probably why I liked it. And then Chicago, but Hong Kong, Singaporean family. But you was a restaurant. You grew up around restaurants, right? Tell us a little bit about what was being served and who was cooking.
So it was a family-run business. My father's first restaurant, he opened in 1969. My mother and father kind of ran the whole restaurants by themselves. And the chef was my grandmother.
No way. Mm-hmm. What was her name?
Kitty.
Kitty.
Of all the names, she decided that she wanted to be called Kitty.
That's
I think when she was immigrating over, she saw a bunch of the Hello Kitty dolls and such, and I think that's where she got inspiration from. And she decided she wanted to be called Kitty.
I love Grandmother Kitty. And what was she like?
She's one of the most amazing people that I think anyone's encountered. She had a nickname for being called the Laughing Lady.
Okay.
She would be sitting in the corner of every one of our restaurants, and you could hear her like bellowing, just this cheerful laugh as you entered the restaurant. So everybody knew her because she
Real
was just
character.
Always in the corner and just laughing. Because at a certain point, once my dad became established enough, obviously she didn't want her working as hard, so she wasn't cooking as much.
So how was she at delegating and sharing her skills? Did she rule with an iron fist?
She, so till date, there's only one copy of her recipes. Till date, I do not have these recipes.
No,
till
who
date,
does?
My aunt in Toronto, if you're, yep. Someone can connect to her.
We will send this. What's
She's
her name?
Still, Auntie Jean.
Auntie Jean?
She has a restaurant in the suburbs of Toronto. And
she's protecting this.
She has this holy book.
Okay.
And I've asked multiple times for it.
Do you think it could be yours next? Kitty's legacy?
I might have to go ninja my way in and just like...
Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
So what was she making? What did you grow up eating then as a result of the restaurant?
So she took a lot of recipes from my grandfather's restaurants and my great-grandfather's restaurants in Hong Kong and brought them over. Yet she managed, even at those times in the late 60s and 70s, she began modernizing and cleaning up those kind of flavor profiles. I think she wanted to make it a little bit more approachable,
yeah,
for the North Americans. So it was quite interesting, but it was still very classic Hong Kong Cantonese style kind of food.
Such as what? Make us hungry.
So the majority of my dad's restaurants in the daytime were dim sum restaurants. So everything was small dumplings and such. And then at night, it was that really comfort food. A lot of fresh seafood, a lot of like slow cooking braised items, and it was just, it was a fun sort of place because it was one of the first in Toronto that served that kind of cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad kind of took that on as a challenge. So every new restaurant that he opened, he was one of the first for everything. So he was the one who brought abalone and bird's nest and all these kind of like really intricate old school Hong Kong recipes to Toronto.
And when did you decide then that this is not just a restaurant for your parents and grandmother, but maybe you wanted to get in the kitchens as well?
That was not a pleasant kind of conversation.
Really?
We were the first generation kind of immigrant kids, the next generation. And generally, these immigrant families have the parents have that dream, you know?
Like, aspirations.
Yeah, I mean, we kill ourselves. We work hundreds and hundreds of hours so that our kids don't have to, so they have access to modern education and opportunities elsewhere, and so the kids can become professionals. You know, and that's always the dream, right?
But isn't that interesting to think how much that perception of being a chef has changed in the last few decades?
It's changing, I would say. I think,
A lot of it's cultural, though.
It's very cultural, I think, and a lot of where I grew, like where my family grew up and such, it's still kind of frowned upon as not a professional kind of job.
So, in a parallel universe, Chef Kelvin, well, what do you think you would be had you followed those aspirations?
Oh, for sure, I would be Dr. Kelvin Chung.
I could see you doing
biology degree. I was in med school.
You even went to med school.
Started it.
And then what was that conversation about leaving it?
I just got bored.
I want to dissect something else.
Yeah.
In the kitchen.
Yeah. I'm still cutting meat. You know?
Yeah, like exactly. Same.
But my parents were not happy. My dad was not happy. And we had that conversation. He was just like, I need you to understand what you're getting yourself into. It's like, you've done this for, at that point, I've already been cooking and working in my father's restaurants since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And he was like, look at our relationship. And I was like, okay, I get it. Because if you're in a restaurant family, I barely knew my until I started working in the restaurant.
Because that was the contact time, that was face to face.
And even then, it was in a very work sort of situation. Mm-hmm.
We should say that you're a father yourself now. But,
yes.
You know, again, the conversation around being an active parent has also changed a lot in the last few decades.
You know, again, we try to learn from what our parents have done because they did their best.
Of course.
And it's our duty as parents now to kind of do our best, but hopefully to end that kind of cycle, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm trying now to
We're going to talk
different.
About your son soon because he's a real source of inspiration, including the broth that we're making today, Bodhi's, and Bodhi boxes as well. So, Chef, looks like we're starting the curry.
Yes.
So we are going to head to a quick break on the radio, but do head over to our YouTube channel where you can watch what's happening. I wish you could do smell-o-vision because it already smells absolutely amazing. Chef Kelvin with us from Jun's as we make his mum's Sunday chicken curry, a broth, and we've got some air fryer tips and tricks. What's your supermarket payday treat? For Chef Kelvin, it's lots of fresh produce. For me, it's frozen berries, maybe a bunch of flowers in a magazine. I don't know when magazines got so expensive, but you know, it does feel like a splurge. Joining us now from Spinney's, Paul Crawford's with us today. He is the category manager of fresh, which is definitely the chicken we are cooking with today. So Chef is going to just be checking on it in the air fryer. We've just been using some, it smells amazing, putting some beautiful spices on some jointed chicken, and that's going into a casserole dish that's on the top of the hob. So Paul, it's Spanish chicken from tell me
Galicia.
Yeah. I never learned Spanish. I learned Spanish for like a month, and I can say tengo 13 años, which means I am 13 years old.
Very good.
That's it, that's the extent of it. So have you been to this farm then yourself?
Not myself, but part of our team has been there. I'll be visiting in November of this year.
Fantastic. So tell us again, for those who are listening on the radio, we just talked about it on YouTube. Tell us about the growing and the farming conditions in this part of Spain in particular. What makes it such a great spot?
Yeah, so what's fantastic about Galicia, and I was saying earlier that I've visited Galicia once in my life, and it did not stop raining for the full day.
The rain in Spain.
So in Galicia, they have a high amount of rainfall, but also benefit from high temperatures. And those two combined make an amazing area for farmland and for the chicken to forage. It's amazing.
Very Copenhagen.
The free range and organic chicken, they're allowed to roam outside and they forage on natural grasses, insects, and it's just a really natural environment for the chicken to be reared on.
That's interesting. So we've spoken before about lamb and how the flavour profile can change depending on the season and what those, you know, what the lamb is consuming, you know, whether they're eating herbs or grass. Do you think it can even get taste from the meat in terms of what those chickens are having?
Yeah, you definitely do. And we've experienced it with like a lot of our key kind of different producers across Europe. One of my favourite ones is that in Ireland, in our organic egg supplier in County Monaghan, the farmer, the producer, has actually implemented different types of grass, and the chicken actually taste up to 28 different types of grass, and it just gives a, such a stronger colour of yolk. So I absolutely believe that has a big, big impact
you
on terms of taste.
Exactly.
Chef, you, can I just ask you quickly, because we can hear the sizzle on the radio, and of course those who are watching this, watching you putting the chicken into this pan. Oh my goodness, I just got the spice. Oh, what oil are you using? You said before using a high smoke point oil. What are you using in
I generally try to avoid some of those seed oils.
Yeah.
Just because as a heat up and you're cooking over a long time, you're breaking them down and you're ingesting a lot of these radical chemicals that aren't as good for you. So just here, we're just using some of the coconut oil. Not only is it better for you, but it just gives you beautiful flavor as well.
I really smell it. Guys, I wish you could smell what's going on. Would you mind just recapping the spices that we've put onto this chicken?
Yeah, so we just toss it with a little bit of coriander, cumin, chili powder, paprika, turmeric, a little bit of Madras curry, salt and pepper. And again, if you have some little ones who aren't into spice, then just avoid it. If your kids grew up eating it and they love it, put it on. Put as much as you can.
I said before, my kind of spice comfort level is most often described as white girl spicy. And they kind of look at me in restaurants and go, mild for you. My daughter is an absolute maniac for spice. And it's only a recent thing. She's 9. She's loving ramen. We go to Wokio quite a lot. And she has the Korean chicken there. And it's like trying to keep everybody happy in the family. Your son Bodhi's how old now?
He's 5.
He's 5, okay. And what's his spice tolerance like?
It's growing. I think as parents, it's more about exposure.
Yeah.
Whether or not they like it or not, I think that'll grow on them as they evolve and their palates change and open up. But it's our job to continually expose them. So even if the first time they don't like it, give it again.
And it's very easy to go, ah, they don't like it, we're never going to try that again. Because it is, it's motive, it's rejection sometimes.
I'm really glad to hear that. There's hope.
Tell us a little bit about your family setup on the spice front.
I've got 3 and a 5-year-old, likewise. And one of the first holidays we took them on to was India. And we had 2 fantastic chefs cooking for us. And unfortunately...
Cooking fries?
Yeah, it was fries, rice and pineapple. Unfortunately, it was just a little bit too much flavour. But yes, exposure, yes.
I mean, what about your own spice level?
Oh, I like to think I can take spice, but I definitely can't. Yeah, definitely mild for me as well.
But with this chicken... I saw before when you saw the whole bird downstairs, it had quite a yellow colour to it. Can you explain why that is?
So yeah, that's a free-range variety of chicken. And that is what we call a corn-fed chicken.
Right.
And that corn-fed diet, so it's fed exclusively on corn. And it gives it that real deep, rich yellow colour. And it allows it to really create a succulent flavour. And it's almost a certain taste profile as well that it gives off. And it just leads to a really different but beautiful eat.
Tell us a little bit then about your travels over the last year or so, because you and the team do go out, and you know, whether that is with, you know, spoken to Neil before from the produce, and he's going to Scotland and trying strawberries and asparagus. And what about you guys in fresh?
Yeah, so in the last year or so, we've managed to travel across to our one of our key beef producers, Stanbrook, in Australia.
Do you have a cowboy experience?
I would have liked more of a cowboy experience. I didn't get on a horse and put a hat on, unfortunately. But no, we visited the outback in Australia. We saw where the grass-fed cattle are raised, and it's just an amazing experience.
Oh, and what about cheese? Are you still looking after cheese?
Yes, cheese for sure.
That was my other payday treat.
What did you get?
I treated myself to some cranberry, the
Wensleydale. Oh, Wensleydale cranberry, yeah. That's very safe. Come on, I need you to go breed them over truffles.
After the show today, we'll go down. And you can push the boundaries into your favourites. What are your current favourites then?
The breed them all with truffles is spectacular.
That's a great treat. That's a good one.
I'm just glad you've moved on from calling me Mr. Cheese. that's what I usually get from you, Helen.
It's about 2 years of calling you Mr.
Cheese. But yes, we went to France last year. Great experience. Went to Rungis Market. And we actually went up to Normandy to visit a camembert supplier, and it was amazing. They showed us camembert made in an industrial format, and then they showed us what they call the PDO, the designated,
origin.
And it's just made in a more traditional method, and the taste difference was incredible.
Really?
And
even though it's come from, from the same area.
It's the same milk, everything, but just produced in different methods. So what we actually did was we brought that Camembert back and we actually did a taste test with our customers to say, look, this is your industrial, perfectly great Camembert, yeah. Solid everyday Camembert, but this is your PDO Camembert, and the taste difference was phenomenal.
What's like, the price difference like?
Oh, I mean, it's probably like 25-30% extra.
Okay.
But I mean, it's definitely worthwhile. Yeah, yeah.
Well worth it.
Yeah.
And do you have cheese on the menu, actually?
So funny enough, because I grew up in Toronto, we're next to Montreal, mm-hmm. and we're blessed growing up with eating a lot of French cheeses. Mm-hmm. And moving to Dubai, my whole thing was, I was expecting, because there's so many expats here, there'd be a huge kind of cheese kind of like following.
Following.
Yeah, because it's something we grew up with, it's everywhere, right? It's a very big part, like it's our natural meal, right? Like we have it for snacks, we have it after our main course, for dessert. So here, it was shocked in the beginning how it, in the beginning it was so hard to find such good cheese. And now we know where to get it.
Now, I've got to say, now you've got a hookup for the amazing truffle cheese.
Yeah, we can go down and grab some.
So Paul, if we're going to be in Spinneys over the weekend, shopping fresh, what things are you putting in our basket? What are some of your current favourites you're excited to have customers access?
One of my key favourites right now is we launched recently our Greek yogurt, our authentic Greek yogurt, I may add, under the Spinneys food brand. And that... You talked about indulgences earlier. Yeah. My indulgence over the weekend, during the week it's Greek style. When it comes to the weekend, it's absolutely Greek yogurt. 100%. I could feast on that all day and night. Just very simply, with some fantastic Spinneys food, strawberries, berries. And I actually found this ginger honey recently. Ooh. And I'm obsessed. With some nuts. I mean, that's my weekend treat.
Paul, thank you so, so much for joining us. Get back to your desk or probably downstairs to go and buy me some cheese. The category manager of Fresh. Chef Kelvin Ovjun's cooking. I say cooking. I'm standing around, assisting, smelling, hopefully tasting later. As we make his mum's Sunday chicken curry, we've just been, actually right now, getting the chicken out of the air fryer. This is going to be going into the super pot to turn into a beautiful broth, and we're also going to be showing a few more tips and tricks as well. Chef Kelvin, we've just got the chicken out of the air fryer, and it's, I have to say, you can just see the crispy texture. Do you know what? Let's have a look.
Look how juicy that is.
So juicy.
And we did nothing. I feel the skin nice and crispy and delicious, exactly how you want it.
Can you just cut through it so we can hear it?
Of course.
Wow. Hear
that? Hear that juice? And we did nothing to this. You can literally go to the store, buy it, go back home. As you're prepping all your other vegetables, do the chicken first, pop in the air fryer. Then as you're washing and cleaning your vegetables, what we do is we'll throw the vegetables straight into the air fryer after we've cooked the chicken. That way it'll cook into that chicken fat that's released below, and you have dinner.
Oh, right, chef. So we are going to be chopping up some of this chicken, and it's going to be going into our pot. So in the pot right now, we've got some of the scraps from earlier. So we should just say, on the chicken curry front, we've just put some potatoes and some carrots in with this beautiful sauce. Thai red curry paste, freshly chopped onion and garlic, a bit of coconut water to deglaze the pan. So that's doing its thing. But with the carrots, the tops and tails, some washed peelings as well, are in the NutriCook to make our broth. Are you having some sickness in your home right now, or is the broth warding away all the nasties?
I think naturally it gives you a nice strong antibody boost. So I think it's one of the secrets to kind of our Chinese culture, where we always magically have broths with every meal, and it really strengthens and boosts your immunity.
So with this broth, I said to you earlier, my daughter's obsessed with ramen, so we could definitely do, you know, cook noodles in this. My other daughter hates meat. So what I've started doing now is cooking things like rice and pasta in bone broth, so at least she's getting a bit of, I guess, protein and goodness there. Tell us a little bit about cooking for kids. Bodhi's 5 and has become a bit of an inspiration. I've said to you repeatedly, I'd quite like to be adopted to you by you after seeing his lunch boxes. They're amazing. What are some things that he might have at school?
So I think with Bodhi, our focus for his meals and his lunch boxes, for us, it was a natural, almost safety blanket for kids. The littles approaching and going into big schools, it's a huge step. Yeah. And they're in a foreign area, they're with foreign people, and seeing foods that they recognize and gravitate towards, mm-hmm. it's almost a comfort factor.
Absolutely.
So it's very important to include these things as part of their day-to-day kind of
touch
life in school.
And
exactly.
Yeah.
And for him, He has some things that he naturally gravitates towards as a five-year-old, obviously. I'll get a message from Andrea saying there's been a request for some salmon sushi or some tuna nigiri.
I genuinely didn't have sushi until I was 25. Not five.
Yeah, a couple times a week, he'll have some sushi.
Love it.
He'll have anything from oats cooked in bone broth or fried rice, that we've cooked in bone broth, pasta. But we try to keep a variety, and we try to keep hints and things that he recognizes that he'll automatically say, okay, I know that's yummy.
And then you can build on that with
unfamiliar stuff. Exactly. And that's kind of how we kind of keep exposing.
It's interesting because when I went to school, we had school dinners, which no disrespect to my British compatriots, were terrible, really, really disgusting. From early years, it was things like mince and tinned vegetables and smash, I'm not even joking, smash mashed potatoes that would be served with an ice cream scoop. And I remember cutting the top off the scoop of the potato and hiding the peas inside and then putting the top of the potato back on again, smoothing it down. But what was good about these kind of meals is that when you were eating with a knife and fork, so you kind of learnt those skills when you were 5, 6, 7, and then we were also eating the same thing. You know, it kind of had this communal feel. And if you didn't eat it, you weren't hungry. And then when we got to high school, I mean, the wheels just came off. It was chips and cheese and gravy and pizza that Italians would weep at the sight of it because it was about, you know, 3 inches thick and had never seen a real tomato or real cheese. And now I feel like it's so hard feeding our kids. Like, it can be such an emotive thing. I think anyone who's spent the money and spent the time to create something that they really, really hope their kid's going to love, and then the mouth jams closed and it's yucky and the food goes... Our dog gained 3 kilos when I started weaning my kids because so much food went on the floor. It's a really, really hard one to try and navigate. And I think what you guys do an amazing job of is just keeping it exciting and keeping it experimental. And as you said earlier, just kind of persisting with... If they do say no, don't close off, oh, they don't like chicken. We're never going to offer them chicken ever again.
So that's one of the things, I think, the biggest hurdles as parents and new parents, young parents, that we kind of throw on ourselves.
Yeah.
You'll slave over this kind of beautiful meal that you think is super nutritious and they're going to absolutely love. And obviously, most of the time, they're not going to like it.
No.
I think it's because we also forget that they're at the age now where their program is to test, explore, and challenge.
Absolutely. And sometimes food can be a way of kind of asserting themselves.
That's all it is. It's not a matter of whether or not your food was good, whether or not it was right for them. This is at the stage that they're at, and we kind of have to be okay with it.
And walk beside them on it. So, Chef, you are removing the bones from this air fryer chicken. Those are going into the pot. Can I ask you a little bit about the NutriCook pot? Because I've had some gadgets in my time in the kitchen, and I never feel like I'm using them right. I don't feel like I'm ever doing them justice, apart from the air fryer, which I love. Do you have one of these in the kitchen at Jim's, and do you have one at home as well? Or why do you like it?
We actually have several of these in the restaurant.
Really?
For things like pressure cooking, slow cooking. I feel like these have a lot more control. So for me, if I'm doing, for example, some of our sauce work, we'll set some bones and whatever. And because we want it super controlled, I don't want it to be boiling at a super hard rate. I want it at a very exact temperature. Also, the pressure cooking helps with a lot of our lentils and beans and such.
Interesting.
So it's a very useful tool, both at home and at work.
Is there anything that you've bought or someone has sent to you and said, oh, chef, you're going to love this bit of kit, and you've just gone, this is just... not for me, I'm never going to actually use this.
So one of the things that I know a lot of people use at their house, but we don't, only because it's just what my kid likes at the moment. People swear by having a really high-powered Vitamix or a blender and such.
NutriBullet kind of thing.
Because it works well for soups, it works well if you're making smoothies and such. My kid just wants plain broth.
I have a NutriBullet that I do use quite a lot because I recently realized that I'm iron deficient, and a big part of that is I crave ice. I love ice.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I just had an iron infusion last week to try and it's going to be interesting to see how that kind of. So I have an ice smoothie every single day. So I use it for that, and then come the weekend you use it for other drinks as well. Very, very useful. What we've bought some things. I think everyone has the bread maker, that was the wedding gift of 20 years ago. Yeah. Never happens. The ice cream maker. We bought a pancake maker a while ago. So it's a griddle pan, and it just has kind of four circles, and it's awesome. Chef, just let's have a quick catch up on our curry, because we've got this lovely base sauce that's been cooking away with the potatoes, with the carrots. The chicken's gone back in now. Where are we at?
So now we're just going to top it with a little bit of our bone broth or chicken stock. Feel free to use whatever's handy. If you're making a vegetarian curry, feel free to use vegetable stock. For us, we always have the stock around the kitchen. We also have it at home. So I like to finish with that, because as it reduces down, not only are you getting that beautiful chicken flavor, more nutrients, delicious, tasty,
smells easy way to do it. Amazing. So back to our broth. Can I ask you about spices, ginger, anything else that you might put in there?
So what I'll do is, we do a lot of these Chinese broths, which are a huge part of our culture. We have a saying in Chinese that every meal, we call it sam song et tong. So it's always three dishes plus a soup. And that was always the balance that we have in our households for our meals. So generally it would be a vegetable or two, and then one protein. And that's what it would be, the three main dishes. And then, of course, from there, then you have the soup. And for the soup, it's always some sort of bone broth. Chinese soups are always a combination of bone broths with specific vegetables that have a direct impact on your body's energies and flows. So depending on the season, depending on the time of the year, we would do different kinds of soups to kind of aid those ailments and such.
So that could be like a temperature thing. It could be
fully.
Really? Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I'm completely ignorant to this. We're going to get the traffic in just a few minutes. Chef, we've just put the lid on the pot. So this curry is going to kind of hang out in here for how long?
So what you've seen was, what I did was I built the curry base. As the curry base cooked out, I added our root vegetables. Generally, when you have root vegetables or tubers, things that take a lot more time to cook, I put those in first for a good 5, 6, 7 minutes, let them cook probably about 40-50%. They will not be finished all the way. And then afterwards, then I'll add or whatever protein in afterwards and let that finish cooking fully.
I wish you could smell what's happening here in the kitchens at Spinney's. Chef Calvin's with us today, Helen Farmer for Farmer's Kitchen. If you are watching, you will see the amazing chicken that's in front of us. We're here at Spinney's Maidan HQ, and it has been an absolute pleasure from start to finish. We've been hearing about chef's heritage, about the location in Dubai. So for anyone that's just tuned in on the radio, we're talking about your tasting menu there and some of the greatest hits. Through, you know, you're working in India and you're through your heritage as well. Is there anything, if you took anything off the menu, that people would be, you know, protesting outside?
I mean, there's one dish that it was one of the first dishes that we made. It's the carrots. It's kind of been kind of iconic with what we do there. It's taken from the inspiration of our childhood, of how mom used to serve us leftovers from the night before, and we got bullied for it because it was always the smelly, weird food that the immigrant kids would eat.
You were those kids.
We were those kids.
And tell us about how it's evolved now into a dish that you're really proud of.
She started making us Canadian food, and one of the things that we fell in love with was a smoked salmon cream cheese bagel. So I try to capture those flavors in a vegetarian form. So we take carrots that are locally grown in Abu Dhabi for us, and we char it over some olive wood and serve it with some local labneh that we hang and then smoke for 5.5 hours with some mesquite and hickory. So in total, there's 5 different types of smoke on this, and then when you close your eyes and take a bite of this vegetarian carrot dish, it tastes like smoked salmon.
Unbelievable. Really, really is. Chef, we have been asking everyone this afternoon to get in touch and tell us their payday supermarket treats. For you, it's fresh produce. For me, it's frozen berries, maybe a magazine or two. Our winner is Wind, who got in touch saying cake and ice cream. Do you know what? I bought some mini magnums this morning. That's going to keep me going through the month. So congratulations, Wind. You have won a hamper of incredible ingredients from Spinney's, everything we've been cooking with today. Our curry's been bubbling, and because the power of YouTube, we actually do have a bit of a here's what I prepared earlier, Chef, I believe. But tell us a little bit about adding in the coconut. Are we going to be adding any cream to this, or would that be done later?
So all you got to do is now, we're just going to double check to make sure our chicken and vegetables have cooked through. If everything's been cooked through and the chicken's tender again, this is when we have the opportunity to add our coconut to finish. Okay, so we'll just take a little bit of our coconut cream or coconut milk powder, whatever is readily available for you.
What do you prefer and why?
So depending on what I'm making, if I'm making more of a Malaysian style curry, we'll use coconut cream. Coconut cream has this luscious, rich, kind of velvety kind of
silky
texture.
Yeah.
And as you cook it down and reduce it, the oil leaches out of it, and we use that to sear our vegetables oven to build those flavors. But at home, I'm happy to use whatever great organic kind of coconut cream and milk you have. This, again, is something that we do at the restaurant. Takes a little bit more effort. This is fresh coconut that we blended and kind of made our own. It takes a little bit of effort. You get fresh fresh coconut, and then you have to like peel it out and then like extract it and peel it and such. So it takes a little bit more work, but I think it yields a much better kind of product.
It looks like foam. It looks like whipped and beautiful.
But again, in your household, it's not about that always. It's kind of just about being able to throw it together.
Feed your family.
Nutritious.
Yep.
Easy, affordable, you know.
Chef's folding in this beautiful coconut. I think we've got some rice going ready as well. So I think if we could get some plates, we might have a little bit of a taste. So for people who are curious about the bone broth, you said before that you're always adding to it. From start to finish, how long do you think it could take?
So generally for chicken, as long as it's on there for about 6 to 8 hours, that's already strong enough. Mm-hmm. We just leave it for overnight, at least a day, to really extract the maximum amount as possible. For you, if you don't have a lot of kitchen counter space and you can't afford to leave something bubbling away for days and days and days, just throw it on for 6 to 8 hours, and then, or right before you go to bed, toss it
perfect.
On.
Perfect.
And then morning, you're ready to go.
What's going in now?
So here we're just
going
to put a splash of the fish sauce, which will give it the salinity, the umami, and kind of round out those flavors. And then we'll give it a quick taste, and then we'll just finish it with some fresh lime juice.
Oh, Chef, we're going to be joined very soon by Laura Coughlin, who has quizzed you in the past about some of your favourite places in Dubai. And you said before how well supportive you've been by the chef community, by the foodie community. Where do you like to go at the weekend for a date night or a family night?
So for
a family lunch, maybe.
We're very simple people. We are not fancy by any means. And for us, we go to kind of our comfort staples. So Bodhi and I, we actually go and get our haircut once a week. It's kind of like our ritual.
I love it.
And right next door, there's an Ethiopian restaurant. And we'll go get our haircuts. And Angela will go to the Ethiopian restaurant, Zagul, and she'll order the food. And by the time the food comes, we're done and ready to go.
What do you eat?
So we generally have the bayonet, which is their vegetable platter. It's served with injera, which
is the bread, right?
Yeah, that lovely fermented sour kind of bread that they have.
Some plates out for us. Okay. Chef, this looks incredible, honestly. Do head over to the YouTube channel, guys, so you can see exactly what we've been making over this last hour with Chef Calvin. And well done to Wins as well. Don't forget, we are with you through until 5 o'clock on your radio. We're going to be speaking to superstar chef Dabas Munoz about Street Show, which is opened here in Dubai, but also about his background as well. A million followers on Instagram, so I'm kind of curious how social media comes into play as well. We're also going to be talking to Laura Coughlin, so if you've got any dining dilemmas, any questions for her, do reach out. We're also going to be talking about how to improve your relationship with food, so well worth getting in touch through 4001 through the app. And through the WhatsApp too. Chef, I think we can have a little dish. Okay, I'm ready.
Scoop a little bit of rice for yourself.
I will, a little bit. This is lunch. Actually, that's not true. I had lunch at 11:30. So I am, that's perfect for me. Thank you.
Okay. Let's grab a little bit of that.
Do you have a curry on the menu then?
We always keep a version of it, and then we alternate throughout the year depending on the season. And currently we do almost a very home style street curry that you get in India that's found on the highways
that's
and
perfect.
Such.
Perfect, thank you.
Yeah, and it's something that I actually love because it's such a beautiful kind of dish.
Have you been back to India since you moved to Dubai?
No,
haven't
had time to do anything right now.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll be able to sneak off and do our first family vacation.
Okay, I'm going to have a taste. You're going to tell me, and everyone listening and watching, what should people order from your menu over the weekend? We're going to Jun's for, well, let's start with breakfast because you've become famed for that. What were you eating at breakfast?
So we do have a fun sort of little brunch menu that we do on weekends. Everyone loves the pancakes and French toast, obviously.
Yes, chocolate chip pancakes.
Yeah, they're gluten-free as well, if that helps. But I love chicken.
That does help justify.
But I love chicken and waffles, and we do fresh baked jalapeno cheddar biscuits, which are actually delicious. come by for dinner, come for the tasting menu, come for the new menu. The tasting menu will be changing very shortly in August.
And then so some cake.
We do have cakes.
He's got amazing cakes.
If you're ever in need of a special occasion or just to have cake.
Just listen, you order cake, that's the special occasion. The special occasion is we have cake. Chef Calvin, just a quick reminder, where can people find you in real life and on social if they want to follow you and eat your incredible food as I am enjoying right now? This chicken is amazing.
You can always find me. My Instagram is Chef Calvin Chung, very easy to find. Otherwise, come see me at the restaurant downtown on the Maiden Boulevard near Burj Khalifa. Anytime, I'll be at June's Restaurant downtown.
Thank you so much, Chef.
This is Farmer's Kitchen on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With Spinneys. Eat well, live well.
Laura Coughlin with us today. She is an industry insider. She's a chef's daughter. She's an editor. She's a broadcaster. And she's become famed recently for speaking to other foodies about their top picks. So everything from favourite bar to best pizza. I mean, we've had it all, and they are absolutely a must-watch. From the likes of Spinney's very own Tiffany, Chef Calvin, who we've just been cooking with now, Jason Atherton, Hatta Mata, it is a who's who. It's so nice to have you with us, Laura. How are you?
Oh, it's so nice to be here. What a cool location to
be in. I know, and do you know what? This doesn't sound so nerdy. I love a supermarket. This is the best Spinneys around, the Maidan one. It's like a mini cruise. You walk around, you're like, oh, it's a charcuterie section. Ah, oh, it's just a relaxing environment. I'm just going to pick some eggs up. Now, I've actually already got a dining dilemma for you.
Hit me.
Because you are out and about speaking to the great and the good. So David got in touch saying, need your advice, heading out for dinner tomorrow night, looking for a fun, delicious restaurant with some energy. Mm-hmm. Any ideas? Oof. Probably more palm end of town than trade centre.
Okay, that's good.
Because when I heard energy, I was like, well, that sounds like DIFC. But the traffic is real. So if we're thinking about a palm end of town, yep. Are there any old favourites or any new additions that you think are worth David's time and hard-earned dirhams?
I would say that there are loads. And I like this end of town a lot more than I do sort of the World Trade Center area anyway. Palm is my go-to brand new restaurant that I think is really, really great.
Go on.
It's called Aretha.
As in Franklin?
As in Franklin.
Okay, go on.
Now, this is a brand new live music venue. It's at the top of Nakheel Mall. It's the Nakheel Mall rooftop, which has become basically the who's who of cool restaurants. So you've got like... which is brilliant, which is another really great option.
That would be fun.
But there's Signor Sassi up there. You've obviously got Tristan Studio up there. You've got a new steakhouse called Three Cuts, which is just open, kind of like a New York-style sort of sexy brasserie. But this place, Aretha, is cool. It is very cool. This is the Rickass Group. They have Twiggy. They have Tago Mago.
Brilliant. La Cantina Ferberg.
And they have created their first live music venue. So this is, I mean, if you want buzzy and you want energy, I mean, they're going to give this to you in spades.
And food-wise, what are we talking about? Because no disrespect to other kind of, you know, dinner and entertainment. Sometimes they're like, you're sitting in the dark and you've got someone in sequins to distract you from the food. And it's
for sure, exactly. But because this is Rickass Hospitality, who have got the pedigree of Mimi Kakushi and Twiggy, you know that the quality of food is going to be great because it's Giles. Chef Giles has been, he kind of like oversees all of the food. Mm. So you can kind of imagine the quality.
So it's not an afterthought.
This is not. This is, in fact, they're both primary, but this is their first take on a live music venue. This is 60s music, soulful 70s. It is cool.
I am on the menu right now, David. So we're looking at oysters, yellowtail, salmon carpaccio to start, and, you know, calamari. Oh my goodness. And
it's then, your faves. It's like the Dubai, it's like it's your standard Dubai great menu that you know is a fail-safe. There's going to be the swanky things, but there's going to be, you know, fries.
Yeah, there are. You've got everything, black cod, rigatoni arrabbiata, you can do a rock lobster to share, but the music, you think, really makes it special.
This is the thing, everyone is up dancing, so whether you want to, whether
do you know
if
what?
You want to or not.
It's so funny, I've got a real craving to go out dancing at the minute.
This is the one, Helen, this
know,
is the one.
But here's my problem, I go to bed really early. So what I want, I'm manifesting this. So Annie Mack, the radio, the BBC DJ a while ago, started a night called Before Midnight.
Yeah.
and you are done and dusted by 11:30, and I'm like, bring that to Dubai, please. Can you do like an 8 p.m. DJ set, and then I'm home.
Do you know who Vicky McClure is?
Yes.
She is in Line of Duty, right?
Yes.
She has created her own day rave.
Oh my goodness.
Where it's literally like 1 o'clock. It's like 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's a day rave from just in the afternoon, and everyone goes mad in a nightclub. It's
okay.
Brilliant.
Now we're answering your dining dilemmas, but if I can put this to you, our lovely Dubai Eye listeners, where can I go for an early dance? That's maybe not,
Zumba not, at like 8 a.m.
No chance. I once did Zumba and I saw myself in the mirror and it was the most humbling experience of my life. I have not Zumbaed since. Laura Coughlin is with us today. If you've got any dining dilemmas for her, David, recommendation there is head to that Nikhil rooftop. Aretha sounds cracking. Mentioned there, three cuts. You kind of think that during the summer there won't be a number of new restaurants opening. Not the case. What else has opened its doors recently?
No, absolutely not. Even on the Palm itself, like we said, it's Aretha, Three Cuts. They're both amazing. Three Cuts is sort of it's the new homegrown concept, steakhouse licensed. It's classic cuts, it's cool, it's got this kind of old school design, very smart. Moving away from the Palm, Alsaco Avenue, you know, this is the cultural enclave. Everyone kind of knew it as, you know, maybe a couple of coffee shops. Mm-hmm. Nightjar has been there for ages, and then you've got art galleries, now restaurants moving in quickly. Coco Row. You've been to Coco Row? Have you heard of Coco Row?
No.
Oh my goodness. This has become like the word of mouth place to go. It's Dubai's first hand roll bar. Yeah. They brought it over from Houston. The guys are behind Pinza and Fire. They're all there's a sort of a collaboration going on there in the past, but this Coco Row place is full every single day. KOKORO.
Coco Row. And what are we ordering?
You're sitting at the bar. There's a counter bar. Everyone, each dish is served to you by hand. So it's a hand roll, sushis. This is really like, you know, top of the line seafood. They are torching Wagyu. They're torching like Wagyu and putting it in rolls. It is really amazing. And considering that it is boiling outside, people are parking their car and walking through Alsaco to get here. This is how popular it's become.
We've also seen Lila
Molino. Lila Molino. You're right.
So Mexican as well now.
Exactly. So right next door to Coco Row, their new best friends is Lila Molino. Lila Molino is the second venue for the Lila Taqueria.
So glad. I have to really think about it.
I know, it's a struggle. But Lila Taqueria was the original venue for Chef Shaw, who we love.
She's ace.
She's fantastic.
You interviewed her as well.
She's great. American, but has learned all of her skills in Mexican restaurants and has brought that to Dubai a couple of years ago. Now they've opened up a new venue in Alsaco Avenue, heavily on breakfast, which is something they haven't done before. Mm. But it's all day, and you can sit in there, and they encourage you, come, sit inside. There's a grocery store downstairs where they're selling local homegrown grocery stuff, like, you know, mushrooms and things like that. So that's really exciting. Mm. But also, it's roasters. They're coffee roasters. They're serving amazing coffee up there. But it's absolutely wonderful and definitely worth a visit.
Laura Coughlin with us today. A message from Ben saying, Phileas Fogg and Wave House both have live music starting early. You're speaking my language here. Tego Mago as well. Thanks, Ben. 4001, if you've got a question for Laura Coughlin. Up next, we're getting the crystal ball out. This time next week, the Michelin Awards will be public. But what are the predictions? That's coming up next. We have got foodie industry insider Laura Coughlin joining us now. And in just about 10 minutes' time, we are speaking to one of the biggest chefs on the planet. Best Chef in the World by the Best Chef Awards for 3 consecutive years. Chef Dabis Munoz is going to be joining us as we talk about Street Show in Dubai, about his heritage and about what's happening globally too. So Laura, appropriately, given Chef's arrival at our Spinney studio, this time next week, there's probably going to be a few sore heads around Dubai because the Michelin Awards are going to be 4th of July at the one and only Zabil The Link, which has become, I mean, a bit of an all-star lineup of incredible restaurants. Now, they are doing a dinner.
Yes.
In the run-up to the Michelin Awards that is costing the princely sum of how much?
Just a grand total of 15,000 dirhams.
15,000 dirhams.
but some might say that it's totally worth it for the caliber of chefs and food that you're going to be eating.
I would say so, because it is...
Also, you need to be very careful with all the chefs surrounding us now.
Absolutely. But I think what they've done so beautifully, and we're going to talk about this in a minute with Chef, is in terms of curating some of the best talent on the planet and bringing it to a truly, and I don't use this word lightly, iconic hotel. It's already become an amazing part of the Dubai skyline. We were there earlier this week broadcasting from Cairo. So what are your predictions then for next week? Michelin, tell us.
Look, it's going to be very interesting. As always, there's going to be shocks, I'm sure. There's going to be things that we're going to champion, and there's going to be things that we'll be upset about. If we remember last year, we've got a few restaurants that have got one stars: 11 Woodfire, Al Montaha, Armani Ristorante, Avatara, Dinner by Heston, Hakkasan, Haseki, Moonrise, Oceano, Tashka, and Torno Subito. Okay, I think my predictions are they all keep their stars. I hope they all keep their stars.
I think a few might lose them.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I believe that Oceano deserves to get a second.
I agree.
So I think that they need to up theirs. But I think there's going to be several restaurants that are going to get a one star this year.
I think that, well, also, when we think about who's arrived on the scene in this last year.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think there are going to be a few new arrivals who are going in hot with one, if not two. And I would say Rowan Fatten's
without a doubt
really deserves to be up
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. Completely agree with you. I think Rowan 45 have shown their talent, have shown that they're here to stay, and their food is really exquisite, so I hope that they get there.
Any other new additions? I think my esteemed colleague sitting next to me might be picking something up next week.
Look, I hope so. I mean, like you said, the caliber of restaurants that have opened up in Wan Zabil, one and only at Wan Zabil, are the best restaurants in the world, so yeah, it would be very unsurprising if any of those don't get a one star, but my vote would be for Street Exo.
Yeah, you go. Tell us what your foodie plans are for the weekend. Where are you going? What are you eating?
Oh, this weekend I'm heading off to a brand new restaurant, another one that's very exciting, which I think you've been to. This is Chef Akmal Anour's new, very cool Uber place.
Fanculio!
Osteria Fanculio. It needs a Michelin star just for the cool name.
Oh my goodness. It's awesome. I've been twice now.
Have you?
Yeah. So Chef Akmal, you know, we think about him being homegrown talent because he's created some incredible concept here in Dubai, but you know, really that Singaporean heritage, unbelievable. You're going to really like it. You're going to really, really like it. It's got this kind of very grounded, feels like it's been there forever.
Okay,
which
amazing.
I think is a real talent of people who are doing restaurant fit outs.
Yep.
So it feels like a kind of Goodfellas Italian neighborhood, pre-theatre kind of vibe, I went with my husband for a date night, and we had some, you know, amazing kind of lighter dishes. Took the kids for Father's Day and had, you know, fresh pasta, really good pizza, and this lovely kind of whipped cream and meringue dessert.
Right.
It's
excellent. So it's a Japanese fusion Italian.
Italian, I would say, dominates
okay,
the dishes.
Okay, Italian leaning.
But some of the dishes have, you know, a kind of a Japanese influence or an ingredient that would kind of surprise you. So some of the pastas, for example, there's beautiful crab pasta on there. So I think you're going to really, really like it.
I can't wait. So that's going to be date night tomorrow.
Fantastic.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to it.
And Laura Coughlin, who else have you got lined up in terms of best restaurant chats that you're having? Reveal.
Look, I've got a list. I've got a hit list. I mean, I'm desperate to speak to Chef Hadrian at Chez Wham. I want to speak to, people always ask me, you know, best brunch. Why don't you Dubai, for goodness sake? You never ask anyone what their best brunch is. So I'm going straight to the source. I'm going to speak to Mr. and Mrs. Brunch.
That's a great idea.
These guys
idea.
Know everything. So I'm going to ask them everything.
What? I'm craving a good brunch right now. I think it's the weather.
You want dancing? You want brunches?
Who am I?
It's like you're 21 again.
It's my birthday next week. Maybe that's the fact.
Well,
I'm craving a party. So best brunch. Gentleman next to me, I might have a contender for that as well. I would say Sissy Social, so to give Jason Atten another shout out for food in terms of bringing the dishes round. Really, really fun.
Do you know
one.
What? I went last week. I went to Netsu.
The Mandarin Oriental.
This was phenomenal. Excellent restaurant. Also deserves some sort of recognition, I believe, in Michelin, as does Jun's. Can't wait to see them get at least a bib. They deserve it. So we love. although I think maybe he's just crashed something, I don't know.
No, but, he's fine.
It's not him. Okay, great. I'm looking forward to, yeah, so Netsu, I think another great brunch, and only 450 dirhams, all in.
Well, I heard that the quality of the sushi is absolutely amazing.
Phenomenal.
I keep on hearing about some new brunches at Atlantis the Royal as well that deserve a visit. So that is a good topic to introduce.
So Mr. and Mrs.
Roundup.
Brunch will be the next one.
Fantastic.
Shout out to them.
Laura Culkin, always an absolute pleasure to find you on Instagram and see some of the videos of the other foodies you speak to. It is Laura by Lorelei. You know when you read headlines about someone and you see them on Instagram and then suddenly they're in front of you and you're like, how is this happening? I'm having that moment right now. We've got an extraordinary guest with us today, Chef Debes Munoz, a culinary genius, and I don't say that lightly. Innovative, avant-garde, talking about some of the first restaurants he'd opened, but also Streetzo, which is here in Dubai. He's been recognised as the best chef in the world by the Best Chef Awards for 3 consecutive years. And recently, set up stop here at One Zabil in Dubai. We're going to be talking about his journey, his inspirations. He has a job to make us hungry in the next few minutes as well. Maybe talk a little bit about brunch as well. Chef, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm amazed you found time to come and sit down for half an hour, to be honest, because you are just a whirlwind of travel, I mean, balancing family life, opening new restaurants, inspiring people. You know, you've had amazing mentors yourself, but now you've taken on that role all over the world. Can we talk about accolades? You know, best chef in the world for 3 consecutive years. I have a feeling there may be some Michelin attention coming your way here in Dubai very soon as well. What does recognition, accolades, awards mean to you? Or is that not why you're doing it?
I mean, all the accolades and recognition are very important for us, but we don't work in for that. We're working to make happy people, and this is the consequence of what we're doing. I'm always saying that I don't feel like the best chef in the world. It's difficult. It's not difficult. It's impossible to say who is the best chef in the world, who is the best restaurant in the world. For who, mm-hmm. first of all, no? Because all of us come from different cultures. We got our likes and dislikes. So.
Yeah, different lens and preferences, and even what we want to eat on one day to the next day, and trends. So that you just stay true to yourself all the time, then.
Yeah, so that's why I'm saying always that I don't feel the best chef in the world. I mean, I'm very happy to be 3 years in a row, because a bunch of people thinks that we are making something spectacular and special. But it's only that. I mean, it's because we are making amazing things, but all over the world, there are many people making amazing things. So.
And some people are doing it, you know, under the radar in a quiet way, and some people do get attention and accolades. And I think what you've done such an amazing thing of is kind of bringing together your influences and being a really positive influence as well to the chef community. Can we go back in time? Can you tell us where it began for you in terms of understanding when you wanted to become a chef?
Wow. You know, no one from my family is working in gastronomy business or something like that, or for businesses. But at my parents' homes, my parents always wanted to. My mom used to. He was housewife, so she used to cook every time at home.
Was she a good cook?
And yeah, she was really good. Okay. And you know, I remember when I was 12, something like that. My parents took me to a very old restaurant in Madrid that was the first very creative restaurant in town, called Viridiana, that is already closed this year. I don't know why, you know, I was like a shock with the restaurant, with the chef, with the food, because we're talking about 32 years ago. So in that moment, 32 years back, no one from my age wanted to become chef, because now it's different. I mean, now
it is. That perception has changed so much because
100%.
Of, you know, superstar chefs.
Now it's like like cool being chef.
Yeah, aspirational.
You know? But 30 years ago, it wasn't. So I don't know. I didn't want to be a football player or a singer or something like that. I wanted to be a chef, but I wanted to be a chef like this chef, like the one from Viridiana.
Isn't it funny though? We grow up eating, you know, our family's food and, you know, trying our friends' family's food. And then sometimes you have this experience, this moment, a meal, where you think, oh, it's not just fuel. It's not just something to eat. It is exploration or celebration or education or innovation.
Yeah,
niche.
And I don't know,
that was like the moment.
And I don't know why that was in my case with 12 years old. Because that restaurant was in that moment very creative, you know. And I was from this moment that I went to this restaurant. Mm-hmm. I was quite obsessed to creative food, you know, to modern food. So I like it to eat everything, but I started to write my own menus with 12 years old. I didn't know how to cook it, you know, but I know how to write it, and I know how to imagine this kind of plates. And all of them was kind of creative, where modern inspiration.
Kind of pushing boundaries a little.
Yeah, something like that. So from that moment, I was thinking, I was clear that I wanted to have a restaurant like Viridiana was, like Diverso.
So that was what success looked like as a 12-year-old. Today, you've got Madrid's only 3 Michelin star restaurant. Can you imagine what you would say to your younger self?
You know, before opening Diverso, I never been working in a 1 Michelin star restaurant even. You know, I've been working in different restaurants in Madrid and in London, but I never worked in a Michelin star restaurant. So the first Michelin star restaurant I worked for was my own restaurant. The second Michelin, the 2-star Michelin restaurant
was yours.
Was mine. And the third and 3-star Michelin star restaurant, the first one to be working for me, was mine as well. So
wow.
So that was crazy.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Because that just goes to show you, it's not about emulating someone else's work.
Yeah.
You know, that is like really being true to what you want to be communicating to people and understanding. You know, tell us a little bit about that initial restaurant, the first time you opened your doors to paying customers.
It's a exciting moment, but as well it's like a very scary moment. Because until this moment, you've been cooking with someone else. I mean, you've been cooking with different chefs, you've been cooking the food they wanted to cook, mm-hmm. and they teach you how to cook it, and maybe you can suggest something, you can add something, but you know, it's not your food, so you are not judged. The people are not paying because of food, your food. They're paying for the food you are cooking for, but it's different. So mm-hmm. the first time you open the restaurant, you feel naked. It's like a wow. And even if you are making something different, because when we opened Diverso, I never say that it wasn't better or worse than anybody, but it was completely different. That's why it was successful from mm-hmm. the day one, because in the old days in Madrid, it wasn't like now. I mean, I opened Diverso 18 years ago. 18 years ago, Madrid wasn't the same exciting city that is becoming now mm-hmm. about food. So that was very traditional in a way. So everyone thought that we are not going to be successful.
You've worked in London, Tokyo, now in Dubai. How do you start to work out where you want to open up, where you want to tap into, who you want to inspire and want to inspire you? Because I ask chefs a lot about, you know, do you travel for food? Do you plan your holidays around where you're
100%.
Going to eat?
Yeah, I thought so. I mean, sometimes I'm traveling always with Christina, and now I'm traveling with Christina and Laia, that is my daughter.
So the family is here, wife yeah. and beautiful baby girl. So that changes things a little bit as well.
Yeah, so Christina is a TV presenter back in Madrid, in television, so she's much more famous than me, actually. So when we became a boyfriend and girlfriend, she doesn't know anything about food. She doesn't care about food, you know? She were asking me if we were making breakfast in Diverso, a 3 Michelin star restaurant, and it was like a...
There's no pancakes.
We don't make breakfast in Diverso. And he was thinking as well that 3 Michelin star is a good restaurant, but we can be 4 or 5 Michelin star restaurant, you know?
it's like a 3 out of 5.
Yeah, so that was this kind of knowledge from
but
her.
But that must have been quite refreshing for you, because I'm sure you
absolutely.
Must... A bit like when I saw you the other night at dinner, I was like, oh, Milani, guess who's behind us? Like proper, you know, you have 1 million followers on Instagram,
so
chef.
We are starting to travel together for food mm-hmm. everywhere, all over the world. And we were planning to go any country, any city, and sometimes, because we were so busy eating everywhere, sometimes we don't know how is a city or a country. I mean, sometimes we're going for a few days to, I don't know, to any part of Europe, and maybe we don't have time to mm-hmm. see the museum, having a walking...
You're just going straight to the restaurants.
Yeah, yeah.
Chef David, we've got a question here saying, why do the restaurants have XO in their names? Can you explain this?
Yeah, so this is a weird, I mean, when I opened Diverso, I used to be traveling, I keep traveling to China and Asia all my life. So I'm always saying that in another life, maybe I was kind of Chinese or something like that. Because I feel like if affinity. I am at home when I'm coming back to China, every time I'm coming back to China. So when I opened Diverso, one of the restaurants that I've been working in London, that was Hakasan, I learned how to make the egg sauce, Cantonese sauce. So it was a way to say that Diverso is going to be diversity and it's going to be different. And in that moment, we had a lot of influence from China. So we changed Diverso with S, in Spanish means diversity. So we changed the S by X, and because of the XO Cantonese sauce. So
all came together. We're going to be talking about Street Sew next. It's here in Dubai, One Zabil. Incredible to be joined today here for Farmer's Kitchen by Chef Debes Munoz. Joining us live, I am so, so grateful for his time, truly. When we always do say Fridays are difficult for chefs because we know how busy the kitchens are, but I think it's safe to say this is one of the busiest and most successful chefs on the planet. Chef Debes Munoz is with us today. He has been recognized as the best chef in the world for 3 consecutive years and is now in Dubai, one and only One Zabil. Street Sew is open and it's getting some great, great reviews. Tell us a little bit about the decision to come to Dubai. I know it's been a long time in the works. And ultimately, we know with your Spanish heritage, with having worked internationally, how do you decide what a Middle Eastern market wants and needs, Chef?
So I think what's happening in Dubai right now in culinary scene is something else, something different to everywhere. You know, now I think it's one of the places to be for gastronomy. Mm-hmm. So when we hear about the project and people talk to us and give us the possibility to come to One Zabil, one and only, it was like a wow. I saw the project and I've been in Dubai so many times before. I love Dubai. My first time was in 2009. That was totally different than now.
Yes, I'd say so.
But you know, now it feels that not only about gastronomy in all terms, but in gastronomy you can feel that there are a lot of different chefs and restaurants doing really something good. So
it's been a real shift, I have to say, in the last, I've been here 17 years now, but in the last 5 to 10, not only amazing chefs coming into Dubai, but also kind of homegrown talent.
Of course.
You know, establishing Dubai as, you know, a culinary capital. And I do stand by that. I really, really do. We've also seen sourcing getting easier, local growing being more feasible. And this has all kind of come together in this alchemy of this is really is the place
to
be.
Yeah, you can feel it. You can feel it.
You can. And the hotel, I think, is an amazing kind of, you know, microcosm of that in terms of the chefs that have been brought together and how well they complement each other.
Yeah.
How do you explain the DNA of Street Sew? Can you give us maybe some ideas from the menu and what's going down well with diners?
So the Street Sew is it's a restaurant that is inspired in all over the world. It's like if you are eating on the street in a creative way, but you can be in New York, Singapore, Madrid, or even Dubai, eating street food is the idea behind about
building the future, celebrating today, stay informed, stay in
to South Asia to eat street food. And first, my first time, I remember first, perfectly my first time in Singapore. You know, this sensation of going in a food hawker center and picking up a lot of different things, bringing to your table and eating all of them in the same time with different flavors, acid, spicy, sweet, sour, salty. You know, it's like a, wow, this is a real part in my mouth, no? So the idea behind all of this, I wanted to do it in a Street Sew. And, you know, Street Sew is a kind of savage restaurant about the experience, about the flavor, about the powerful, because I'm obsessed with flavor. So when we been thinking to come to Dubai, I have doubts. I thought, okay, what kind of Street Sew do we have to make in Dubai? Mm-hmm. Have to be the same savage that in Madrid, or maybe we have to go mild or less savage?
Tame, yeah.
Yeah, so I've been talking with the...
No.
Yeah, I've been talking with the main people from the one and only One Zabil. And I asked them, okay, what do you think? Do you think we have to come less savage that we are in Madrid? So they came to Madrid once again. And they said, no. Dubai needs something different. You are here because you have to bring something different. So we did it as savage as Madrid or even more. So and people love it, so it's a good addition.
It's been described as organized chaos that slaps you in the face, kind of roguish reimagining. What are some of the star dishes, the ones that you're really excited for people to try?
So we keep creating new dishes only for Dubai. Now we create, in my last visit, in this visit, we create a kind of lobster awakening on the Goa beaches. We call it like that. So it's a lobster that is tastes like a Indian lobster, but in our own way. So the other day came to take dinner one of my best friend chefs in Dubai, that is Imansu from Trishin Studio. That I love the restaurant.
He's
to me is
so special.
To me, for all the Indian restaurant that I know, is the best Indian restaurant in the world.
Incomparable.
Absolutely. And that was his favorite dish on the dinner.
So it's a hit with the chefs.
It was because we did it well. So
you're doing a brunch, the winged tapas brunch, and I saw a video of it last week and I was like, this is where it's at on a Saturday afternoon. Now, we think about brunch being like, you know, a New York or a European concept. Dubai does brunch in a very different way. How much fun are people having at the Street So Brunch? A lot.
A lot. You know, this is my first brunch cooking as a chef. I never did a brunch before, but you know, every time I came to Dubai, I went to see different brunch in on town, and we wanted to make something different once again. So I tried almost all of them, and I was clear about how it's gonna be our brunch in the Street So. A real roller coaster with a lot of things, full of flavor, full of fun. It's like a Cirque du Soleil.
Music.
It's like a Cirque du Soleil of the brunch.
And we've had a message here from Rohit saying, what advice would this amazing chef give the next generation? Interesting, because as I said, you are now a mentor, you're a father. And when you think about, you know, youngsters coming up through the ranks who want to emulate your success, who, you know, can't even dream of having the stars and the accolades, what do you say to someone who...
You cannot be working for this kind of accolades. I mean, you are successful when your restaurant is full bookings. And this is the real thing, you know, this is the best thing in the world. Mm-hmm. So when everyone's were asking me, I was the second youngest chef in the world to get the third Michelin star, just behind Alain Ducasse. So mm-hmm. everyone were asking me, what did you do to get the third Michelin star at this age? And I said, I wasn't looking for that. You know, I was just trying to improve my restaurant every day, just trying to be my best version than the day before. Even right now is the same sensation and the same goal. So the best advice I can give to somebody that young from this industry is just trying to find your way, trying to be successful, just fully booking your restaurant, making people happy. And then recognition and awards will come.
So when you were 12, success looked like opening your own restaurant in Madrid. What does success now look like? You're in your 40s. Where do you think you're going to be in 30 years' time, chef?
I don't know. You know, I understand successful in a very different way now. You know, I understand as well the industry in a totally different way. So now I'm just working, for example, Diverso. Is going to exist just because I want to get fun, because Diverso is a difficult restaurant to manage. Is the it's a restaurant that is not losing money, but as well is not making money. So I just want to be happy and being fun
now.
And making people happy. That's all.
Well, you've really, really, it's been a thrill to have you today, Chef. It really, really has. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We are so lucky to have you in Dubai. Brunch sounds amazing. I've got my fingers crossed for you for Thursday night. And next time you're back, I won't play paddle with you because I think you're a lot better than me, but I will definitely see you in the restaurant. Chef Davis Munoz, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Today we have the pleasure of speaking with Yulia Federicina. She is the founder, the CEO of Ribambelle, a family restaurant concept that has been making waves around the globe. She's got a background in both corporate world entrepreneurship and has expanded this concept to multiple countries, including a new location here in Dubai. She's also a mum of three and brings a unique perspective of this idea of balancing professional success with family life. And the restaurant is the perfect example of that. Yulia, thank you so much for being with us and congratulations on the launch. It sounds like it's going incredibly well. How are you today?
Thank you, Helen. I'm good. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I want to ask you about the name, Ribambelle. Before we talk about what it is. Tell me about what it means.
Ribambelle in French means a lot. Usually it's associated with kids, like a lot of kids, but it can be a lot of everything. It's not commonly used word. Not even all French people know it.
It's a beautiful word.
But it's exactly about our concept.
Like, and then when you explore what exactly you are about, it is a lot. Tell us a little bit about where the idea came from, because the point of difference to my mind is my kids are a little, you know, they're 7 and 9 now. If there had been a place that was stylish, that served great food, maybe drinks, and they could play, I think I would have moved in. Where were you 5 years ago? Tell us where the idea came from and how it's translated into bricks and mortar now.
I'm totally with you. The idea came from my own need. You know, my oldest son, he's already 17. So 12 years ago, I already was thinking about we women, we feel guilty on the weekend, you know, when we work a lot on the weekend, we want to spend time with our kids. Also, we want to relax. We want to have quality time together, but we don't have sometimes energy or time to prepare this good quality time. So my idea was to help mothers, to help mothers like myself, who wants to combine and have it all in our life, and also spend time with our kids. So kids feel happy, they can play, they can be themselves. Parents can help, can have good food, relax, guilt-free time, so that we, like our kids, don't play iPad, they're not left with nannies. We spend time together.
So here, my husband's in the UK, so he's definitely not listening. But what I will say is something that we have historically had disagreements on is he's got very high expectations of the children's behavior in dining in restaurants. Even when they were younger, even when they were 3 and 5, he'd be like, no, they should be able to sit still for 15 minutes before the food comes. And I'm like, Farms, they're never going to do it. So let's bring coloring, you know, whatever. Even better if there's somewhere for them to go and play and run off some energy before the food comes. So for anyone that hasn't been to Ribambelle, and you've had some amazing social media coverage as well since you opened a few weeks ago, can you describe the space?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but your question, it's amazing what you raised. This question is, I came up with this idea after my MBA, and I did my MBA at INSEAD Business School, which is in France. And my son, he was 2 years old back then, and we were living in France for 1 year, and I was always shocked that they really expect kids to stay still in the restaurant. And I never knew how to make it, you know, how can I put my kids
how is it
still?
Possible?
It's not possible. Mm-hmm. I was admiring French kids who actually could do this, but I never managed myself.
They've written books, French children don't throw food, apparently. I know a few French children, and they definitely do.
Exactly. So I never managed to do this, you know, my kids were never still, and I think it's quite normal for kids. And yes, the idea is that kids play on a playground, it's not huge, but it's enough for all kids whose parents are in the restaurant accommodating. So, and parents, while they are waiting food, while they talk, while they have a nice meal, kids can play in a playground, be active. They can go to art and craft studio for those who are more creative. And also we have cooking classes for kids. So there are multiple activities for kids. They can be busy for 2 hours, which is average time of our adult meal, right? Mm-hmm. So when I go with my friends, with my husband and like families, few families together, we can have a nice chat. We can like have normal discussion. Of course, our restaurant is much more noisy than the restaurant without kids. I mean, this is something we cannot do.
But it's also, it's a judgment-free zone. What I just want to come back to, and we're going to talk about the menu in just a minute, is the style, the aesthetic is beautiful. It's not like a cafe in a soft play, which is all garish and wipe clean and primary colors. And it's designed in a kind of quite, you know, immature, infantilizing way. It's terracotta and, you know, teal and natural.
And wood and marble.
Yeah, it's really, really stunning, Yulia. We're going to talk about food next. And yes, cakes. We're having a sweet end to our Friday afternoon. Family restaurant concept that has global presence but is now in Dubai. It's at Blue Waters. I've had a number of you asking for the details, so I can tell you, if you want to send me the word family, I will send you the Instagram, but you really need to see it to believe it, because it's bringing together play spaces, we talk about kids' cookery, but also amazing food, licensed upstairs, and it's already, well, you've been full since you opened, Yulia. Did you imagine to get such a response?
Yes, every weekend we are full.
Wow.
Yeah, we will like it.
You should be delighted.
I am.
Tell us a little bit about the food, because as I said before, when you kind of think about this family-friendly concept, like you think, okay, it's going to be bright and garish, and it's going to be, you know, deep-fried turkey dinosaurs.
No, we absolutely not about our cuisine. We have a mix of European, Italian, and French cuisine, and of course popular different dishes which we now very like, and tuna tartare. We don't know from which exactly cuisine it is, but it's like just the European, we call it, right?
Do you know so what? Every restaurant in Dubai has one, and I am here for it. So exactly. You got from Korean akibidori to, I went to an Italian restaurant the other day, they had a tuna tartare. So
absolutely,
just joining the gang. And then is there a kids menu as such, or how do you do it there?
So we have kids menu, of course, and of course we have for example French fries, which kids like. But what I do offer, and what is like was always my pain as a mother, is to offer something more healthy, and so that kids and mothers have choice. Mm-hmm. So for example, we do have pizza, but we have pizza, gluten-free pizza. We can have lactose-free desserts. We can have cutlets and chicken, which we use for the kids menu, is organic. So for me personally, it was always very important. I did change a little bit concept because of the trend, and people were asking. For example, in my first restaurant, for first 2 years, I did not have French fries. And
then you bowed down to the feedback.
And you can imagine how many complaints we had.
Well, I'm looking at the menu now, so I'm immediately going, okay, one of my daughters will have the chicken dumplings, like, no doubt, sounds amazing. Or lamb meatballs. But then my other one's going, she's having chicken tenders and French fries. You know, like, Dubai kids are interesting because, you know, if they've been born and raised here, they might be quite adventurous eaters. But then we have a big American influence here, and everyone wants French fries on every menu. So it sounds like you're doing a good balance. Can we talk about cakes?
Of course, absolutely.
Oh my gosh. I am already thinking about my daughter's birthdays because the cakes look absolutely amazing. Tell us a little bit, because you've got gluten-free options, end of year collections, you know, it just looks amazing. So are you doing parties in the space, or can you people order a cake to take home as well?
We are doing both. We actually also act as event agency, because in our restaurant we have everything. We have entertainers, so kids not only play on the playground, they're entertained. So this is why they play with each other, they're interested. And the same people, they can be part of your birthday party, I mean, kids' birthday party. Mm-hmm. So we are doing cakes, we are having catering company, we have entertainers, and all these, of course, we can bring outside of the restaurant and do party, like at somebody's villa.
What's your favorite cake, Yulia?
You know, it really depends on the chef. With this, we have amazing pastry chef in Dubai now. My favorite, yogurt cake, which is something I cannot stop eating, so I would not order it.
We were just talking before about being working mums and how your kids think you have the best office in the world.
Yes.
They get to come to your work and go on a slide and then have a lovely lunch. I mean, how lucky are those kids?
So my kids, in the morning when they don't want to go to school, they always say, like, Mom, you're lucky, you're going to the playground and we have to go to school. Life is unfair.
And you're like, I'm in the back room on the Excel spreadsheet. I'm not in the ball pit anytime soon. For bookings, I think, as I said earlier, you've been fully booked since you opened, really. How far in advance do you recommend people book for weekend breakfast or weekend lunch? And we had a message going, what time do you close? So advanced bookings, what do you recommend, Yulia?
I do recommend advanced booking, although we are moving to the summer season. We all know what is summer in Dubai. So, of course, we won't be as busy as we used to be. We are working from 10 to 10. But of course, if there is birthday party and people want to stay later, we will stay with them. And potentially, we might open earlier on the weekends since September, because young, like, you know, like kids.
Okay.
At 2 years.
I am going. This is going to be my mission in Dubai. My kids wake up at 6. By 10 o'clock, it's lunchtime. So I'm whether it's a water park or a restaurant, I'm all about the early opening. So I will support you in that decision, Yulia. Thank you so much for your time today. Huge congratulations.
This is Farmer's Kitchen on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With Spinneys. Eat well, live well.
We're talking about eating well and living well today and how these things intersect. And it's a bit of an emotional one because I think so many of us struggle with our relationship with food and try to combat this pervasive influence of diet culture. And through her work, our next guest, Ritu, has really witnessed the struggles of disordered eating amongst women in particular of all ages and demographics. And she focuses on highlighting the negative impact of diet culture, exploring disordered eating behaviours, and offering really compassionate and practical strategies strategies for developing a healthier relationship with food. Her client, Kanak, is with us as well. Thank you both for your time. Really, really appreciate it. As I said, it's a very emotional thing for a lot of people. And I want to put this to you. How many people do you think have an uncomplicated, neutral relationship with food?
To be honest, I think it's nearly, I want to say 10% of people I come across. Mm-hmm. So majority of the people that I work with or I know personally, including myself at some point when I started my journey, I was diagnosed with not an eating disorder, a full-blown eating disorder, but like a disordered eating pattern and behaviors. And it's so ingrained and we're so conditioned and brainwashed into thinking that we need to be a certain aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And now that there's a resurgence of heroin chic coming back into the
90s.
Picture, yeah, mm-hmm. You see all of the celebrities, Kim Kardashian, I mean, they're not, I would say they're the victims. They're not the ones kind of starting the trend. We're all kind of, again, brainwashed and conditioned into this. So it's just a byproduct.
And it starts so young.
So young.
We were talking earlier in the week with a financial expert, Emma Edwards, and she was saying that women are taught more about calories than they are about finances. And I remember going to, I don't know if this was a global thing, Rosemary Conley, who was all about like low fat and aerobics and going to the local village hall when I was like 12 with
Weight
my
watches.
Mum. Yeah. You know, and how much we kind of reflexively know how many calories are mm-hmm. in a banana, mm-hmm. how long it would take to burn off X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
So you are fighting a really big battle here to kind of deprogram women. Yeah. Can you share maybe some of the common challenges that you're hearing from clients? Have you noticed any patterns, especially here in the region or two?
So calories being number one, to be very honest, because now again, everything that we eat has a nutritional label. So instead of looking at the nutrition part of the label, we look at the calories.
The numbers.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of hoo-ha about, okay, if I'm eating X, how many calories am I eating? Versus what can I eat that will better my nutrition or my wellness or my health?
So isn't that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because sometimes we think about food as, my dad's like thinks about food as fuel.
Yeah.
He's super like post-war, will eat anything. Yeah. Don't think he really understands what a calorie is. And he eats for health and fuel.
Yeah.
Whereas I think we have this kind of really hard thing to unpick, and it's something I'm trying so hard to not pass on to my children about good food and bad food.
Yeah. Oh, that's a big topic. That's a big topic of food demonization.
I had a healthy lunch so I can be a bit quote unquote naughty tonight.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I found myself doing with my kids. Okay, you know, if you eat all the cucumber, then yes, you can have whatever you want for
like
dessert.
Like a piece of chocolate or something, yeah. So food demonization is one of the pillars of diet culture, unfortunately. So when you categorize foods like good or bad and think about it in such a dichotomous black and white way, mm-hmm. you will always look at food like that, unfortunately. And when it comes to food, yes, food is fuel, but food is also celebration. It's also nostalgia. It's mm-hmm. also health. It's so many other things apart from just being fuel.
So how do you work with clients then? Tell us a little bit about that client experience. Then we're going to speak to Kanak and find a little bit more about how that's going with her.
Oh, it's very case to case. Every client is different. And to understand someone's context, that is number one. So a lot of nutritionists and coaches, PTs, they work with clients on a very cookie cutter basis in the sense that here's a cookie cutter plan. I've made it for client A and I'm going to go distribute it to 100 other clients. But when it comes to coaching, especially in this realm, when you're trying to figure out disordered eating, you need to be very, very specific. You need to understand someone's bio makeup. So that's your genes, your genetics, your medical history, family history. And then there's your psychological health. Mm-hmm. So understanding someone's emotional well-being, their psychology when it comes to food, health, and body. And then there is your social aspect and factors. So for example, the environment you're in, because co-regulation is so important.
And that could be family, but it can also be culture. It can be heritage.
Exactly.
If it's not too personal a question, can I ask you why you reached out to Ritu for help around exactly that, talking about the day-to-day nutrition, but also the psychology of it as well?
It's funny you ask, because I think I reached out to Ritu. It really started because I wanted to kind of go back to being good as far as food is concerned.
So and clean.
Clean, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's, in fact, the opposite of kind of, it's pretty much the takeout of it was so different from the reason why I started out. So I started out because I kind of felt like I needed to lose more weight and I kind of wanted to fit in a certain type, body type. But I think, again, like I said, the narrative kind of changed by the end of it. Because I think having spent time with her made me and sort of helped me realize that I need to stop labeling food. I need to kind of eat with intention and think about how food is making me feel, mm-hmm. you know. So I think the food demonization part is something that I think I've managed to really kind of change in my mind, all thanks to
Ritu. That's huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I'm probably speaking on behalf of a lot of people. I become... obsess is a strong word, but food preoccupies a lot of my thoughts.
Yeah.
That's
you know, it's waking
one.
Up and what am I going to eat today? What am I excited to eat? What shouldn't I eat today?
Yeah.
And that has been my psyche for decades. And sometimes it's more pervasive.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
sometimes I feel a bit more neutral about it.
Yeah.
The author Richard Osman spoke about this recently. He was talking about food addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting to hear it from a man, but he was just saying, you know, imagine what I could accomplish if I wasn't thinking about food so much.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's very, very complicated because I have been a lot bigger.
Yeah.
And I've been, this is probably the lightest I've been since I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And what I wish I'd known, I could speak to myself like 10 years ago. Well, just because you reach a certain number on the scale, or just because you can buy a small or medium in Zara, doesn't necessarily equal happiness.
No. Yeah.
But we have been sold this.
Yes. So yeah. This is my entire thesis in life. So the preoccupation that we have towards food and body, the cost of it. So understanding the opportunity cost here, what are you actually missing out in life?
Mm-hmm.
Are you missing out in terms of the time you can spend with your family, your kids, your siblings, going out with your friends, socializing? Because I see this quite often. And I see girls as young as 14, 15 staying at home, not socializing because they're scared of what people might say or how people might judge them.
For what they're eating or for what they're not eating?
For what they're eating, for really? What they're not eating, how they look, how they don't look, what they wear, everything.
And then it becomes this idea of secretive eating,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
of not
night
being
binges.
Able to be in the world. A message here from Laura saying, food equals medicine in my home. I love this idea of feeding ourselves, of nourishing our bodies and listening to our bodies. I don't think I do that that often.
Yeah. So again, internal cues. When you've been told, or this diet culture has sold this idea to you, that you need to suppress your hunger. I used to have a client who used to have an apple a day and feel this sense of joy and pride, rather pride, not joy, that I've just had an apple. That's it. And that makes me feel better than the person sitting next to me, because that's as low as I can go when it comes to my hunger.
So that was a willpower control superiority thing as well?
Yes. So we confuse diet culture for willpower all the time, assuming that the little that we eat or the little that we are in our bodies, the better we will be. Again, the same conversation as...
There's been a lot on social media over the last couple of weeks that I've noticed, which is talking about trying to keep women skinny.
Oh, yes.
So we're
it's
too tired.
Patriarchal.
Yeah, so we're too tired to do anything else. How do you feel about that?
So I love that because Naomi Wolf, she had this massive quote, which I'll send you later, but it's just all about that. It just makes women... So you know when you sidetrack women into thinking that they need to just be preoccupied with food and body and whatever?
Mm-hmm.
They're not there out there changing the world, are they? So it's a patriarchal brainwashing mechanical system that they've created.
I've got the quote. It's from the beauty myth,
right?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
A culture fixated on female thinness is not an obsession about female beauty, but an obsession about female obedience.
Yes.
Dieting is the most potent political sedative in women's history. A quietly mad population is a tractable one. Ritu Sukramani. We've also got her client, Ganak, who's been working with her on improving that relationship with food. And we've had a message here saying, what does your guest think of this book? And it's Tim Spector's book about the science of eating well.
Yeah.
What's your take? Are you familiar with it or some of his work?
Well, some of it, yes. So I think it's a really good book to start with because he does kind of go into pseudoscience, which is basically science that's been made up. There was this other article that I think I shared as a reference to the celery guy. Are you aware of him? Mm-hmm. The medical medium. And Tim Spector kind of dispels a lot of like those kind of myths.
It's amazing, isn't it, how we pick up things and we just run with them. So you must be doing 10,000 steps a day.
Yeah,
you must
be
having 8 glasses of water a day. And actually, as you said before, it's not a one size fits all. When I think about, you know, losing weight, what worked for me is not going to work for other people. You know, when it comes to exercise regimes, that could, you know, injure one person, but could be the making of someone else. So I find it so interesting how these become just woven into our, you know, consciousness and what we think of being fact and knowledge.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about you know, some effective strategies for combating the negative influence of diet culture in our daily lives. Ruthie, what would you love to see everyone listening today doing, changing, avoiding, unfollowing?
Everything.
If you could wave a magic wand over the UAE to make us, what would you do?
So the first thing, because we were talking about food demonization, right? So the first kind of exercise or tool that I tried to experiment with my clients, again, every tool is, it depends on the client itself. So if it works with them or resonates with them, then it's okay. Mm-hmm. But we start with something called removing food labels. So when you look at food labels, again, the whole idea is good or bad, healthy, unhealthy. But I try and get people to start describing food based on how it smells, how it tastes, what are the textures are we talking about, what are the colors are we talking about. So that kind of goes back, and this is an exercise that a lot of my clients do with their children as well. So it's the idea that we look at food from a neutral point of view versus, okay, this is good for me and this is bad for me, this is healthy and unhealthy.
Can I ask you, having worked with Ruthie, what are some of the changes that you have made, whether it is, you know, environmental, you know, how you shop, how you think, what do you think has been the most, your kind of biggest learnings?
I think the first one being, to her point, is definitely sort of undoing food labels. So I feel, and I find myself pretty mindful of that now, especially now that I'm a mom and my daughter's 14 months. I feel like it's so important for me to kind of stop saying things like, oh, that's, you've got to focus on, or I want to focus on clean eating, because there's no such thing, you know. There's really, eating a donut isn't really the worst thing for you. Are you enjoying it? How are you feeling about it? So really, I think that, besides, again, a lot of somatic work. So, you know, what are the things that make you feel good, you know, and how do you feel post it? So you eat a meal and assume there's, you know, I've eaten something and I want to talk. Again, in my session with Ritu, I'm like, listen, this is what I ate. And her first question has always been, how has that made you feel? You know, and I think it's a lot.
And that, sorry to interrupt, but that kind of idea of feel, it's kind of two-pronged, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did it make you feel in your body?
Yeah.
Did you feel uncomfortable?
Yeah.
Did you feel nourished and, you
healthy,
know, healthy?
Well.
But also, how did it make you feel, you know, psychologically? Mm-hmm. How did it make me feel, oh, you know, I'm eating this to punish myself, or I'm eating for celebration? And we've had a question here about stress eating.
Yes.
Yeah. So this was me in the pandemic. I could not stop eating red licorice.
It was
a problem. Why do we eat when we're stressed?
We cope. This is how we cope with life, isn't it? And when you cope with life through food, it's not the end of the world, it's not a bad thing, but understanding that you can have more coping mechanism strategies in your toolbox is key. So coping with food is not bad in the sense that during the pandemic everyone used food to cope with what was happening around us, right? And that's just normal, that's just organic, that's just natural, because we're human beings at the end of the day. And this is something that we've known for so long. However, there are other tools that we can use as well.
What do we do if we're worried about someone in our life, Ritu? What if it is a partner, a child, a sibling, a friend? And you mentioned before, you know, maybe becoming more introverted because they don't want to eat in public, or you're noticing, you know, behaviors like hiding food, or even, you know, binge eating, purging. It's such a difficult conversation to have, and it's probably a conversation they can't even have with themselves, never mind even the people closest to them. What can be effective? You're making a face at me.
No, because this is uncomfortable. I'll tell you something, that a lot of people who are in this cycle of disordered eating behaviors and patterns, they have made this their entire life, right? And that kind of awareness, self-awareness, will only start and begin once we do our inner work. And inner work is quite hard. It's
easier not to do it.
Exactly. It's easier to mask everything, to just go along life saying, yeah, this is life. I like to be this way. I like to calculate every single calorie that I'm eating, for example, or I eat in secret. This is my identity. So to kind of go in as a third person, or, you know, as a parent, as a sibling, as a friend, it's so difficult because they don't see it for themselves yet. But the idea is to try and make it completely neutral
and just be there for them
and do the work yourself. I always say this.
Message here from Prashant saying, thank you for this interview, I'm so glad to hear it, appreciate you talking this. Ritz saying, ladies, eat, drink, travel, try new cuisines, take care of your health the way it works for you, do it alone or do it with close ones, leave the worrying to those who are trying to fit in. That's my motto on life and food. On that note, I'm going to have a giant slice of cake that Chef Kelvin left us.
Share it with me, please.
Absolutely will. Grab a fork, ladies.
Thanks for being with us on this episode of Farmer's Kitchen. You can tune in live every single Friday afternoon between 2 and 5 on Dubai Eye 103.8.